Latitude Media, podcasts at the frontier of climate technology.
Whether you realize it or not, we've all been interacting with some form of AI for a long time, in the form of product recommendations online, bank fraud alerts, social media algorithms, voice assistants. But the last year and a half has been very different. It brought this explosion of powerful generative AI tools for creating images, video, audio, and text that are quickly reshaping how we perform creative work, organize and query data, search the internet, and even run political campaigns. And many people believe we're entering yet another new era of AI, the era of agentic AI. These are systems that can autonomously make decisions on your behalf with minimal input. Send emails, plan a party, book your next vacation. Now, I follow this space very closely, and even though I'm endlessly fascinated with how AI is going to reshape the way we think, execute tasks, run our companies, which it most certainly will, I'm basically only using it around the margins. Recipe ideas, bulletized summaries of long documents, maybe making up a story about a character that my four-year-old loves. Giving an AI agent control over my emails, or even making decisions out in the real world, which is coming very quickly, is not something I'm comfortable with yet. And in many ways, that mirrors what we're seeing in the power sector. We have used machine learning on the power grid for a long time, for things like load forecasting, advanced meters, predictive maintenance. But now, thanks to this explosion of computing power, wildly better models, and a host of new pressures on the grid, there's a compelling AI use case for nearly every piece of a utility's operations. But utilities, they're like me, and probably you. They see the potential benefit, they know it's coming fast, but most are still dabbling. They see it as an enhancement. So when will this enhancement turn into full-on transformation? Over the last 6 months, our team at Latitude Intelligence has been talking to the power companies that are evaluating and investing in AI and the vendors that are integrating AI into their products. And just this week, we released that Utility AI Insights report. The TLDR, there's a ton of activity right now, and it is not just hypey, hand-wavy stuff. So to mark the release of this analysis, we're featuring a conversation that we recorded recently at DistribuTech that puts some of our team's analysis into context. We pulled three experts together and tested their knowledge about some of the macro forces bearing down on the grid and where AI fits in. And if you want to get access to that Utility AI Insights report, go to latitudemedia.com/research. And now here's our roundtable from DistribuTech. We are living in an increasingly automated world. From personal banking to document management to creative tasks, AI is suddenly in use everywhere. And it's coming for the power sector. New research from Latitude Intelligence and Indigo Advisory Group shows a coming wave of broad adoption inside and outside of utilities. Distributed energy companies are increasingly integrating machine learning and AI into their products, and many power companies are building teams to take advantage of automation for operational efficiency and grid monitoring. But an autonomous super brain for the electric grid is a long way off, if it ever fully materializes. And today we're going to break down the pathways for AI in the electric grid and test the knowledge of a few leaders in the space. We're joined by David Groark, who's the managing director of Indigo Advisory Group. He led a first-of-a-kind study on the pathways for adoption of AI-based solutions in the power sector with our team at Latitude Intelligence. Hey, David.
Hey, Stephen.
Sadia Ravindran is the VP of Industry Solutions at Uplight. Her team designs and implements flexibility management programs using AI-driven software. Hi, Sadia.
Hey, Stephen.
And Apoorv Bhargava is the CEO and co-founder of WeaveGrid, a company focused on integrating EVs on the grid and turning them into flexible assets using machine learning. Hey, Apoorv.
Hey, Stephen.
Okay. So, David, we'll just start with some opening questions here. David, you've been working in the power sector for 20 years. You've seen a lot of technological waves. What wave are we in now, and where does AI fit in?
Yes, we are in a new age for digital technologies in the grid. You know, in the last 20 years, there's been huge investment in sensors, communications infrastructure, and utilities have touched a lot of technologies. And they've been partnering with the market quite effectively. And we're at this interesting point where we have a lot of this data. We have capability being built within the utility, and we have increasingly complex problems to solve both on the grid and at the edge of the grid. And this is providing utilities with a great opportunity to leverage this capability that's been building for the last 20-odd years. So this is really a new age for utilities. And we look to the next 20 years, we're going to see automation play a huge factor in how the grid is managed.
So Apoorv, WeGrid is developing software that uses machine learning for EV integration. And last year, for the first time, global EV investment overtook renewables investment. What made you focus on this market in particular, given the momentum in EV adoption?
We started the company about 6 years ago, 5 to 6 years ago. I'd say six because that's when I started tinkering with it. Five when you actually count when the company started. 5 years ago, when we came to places like DistribuTech and talked about EVs, it was like, oh, that's cute. That'll be fun, I think, when I can drive an electric car and it causes problems on my grid. I think the challenge is, how do you bring together the device that is fundamentally the most personal to any consumer? I haven't named my thermostat. Actually, I have never named my solar panels, but my car has a name. All my cars have had names. It keeps a bunch of junk in there, and it's a very personal device. I think that when you actually look at the country, the fact that there are 280 million cars, more than double the number of households in the country, starts to give you a sense that if each of those has anywhere between a 15 to an 80 kilowatt hour battery in them, imagine the amount of just sheer flexibility that that aggregated resource can provide, not just in balancing a lot of the bulk system integration challenges that we're going to have with a lot of the new renewable energy systems that are coming online, but really fundamentally, and what we think maybe too obsessively about, is how does this impact the delivery system, the T&D network? And in the upending of energy economics as we've known it today, when we move to a world where the delivery and the network will outstrip the cost, as it is today already, the cost of generation, AI plays an incredibly important role in creating the right personalized schedule for managing the charging and discharging of those vehicles and creating a customer experience that really comes together with the operations teams inside of a utility. Because that bridge, when we were talking about this just before we even got here on stage, DistribuTech now has consumer-related applications and teams where 15 years ago it was transformer companies. The bridge between the distribution operations team and the customer teams, that is coming. You know, that bridge is being built very quickly, and EVs are at the center of that. And I think you cannot actually build it without machine intelligence, because fundamentally a grid operator cannot be sitting there hitting a button trying to control 280 million cars, you know, with their finger. So that's where AI is going to help a ton.
So Sadia, you have, over your career, gone from building renewable power plants to product management in wind for large wind turbines to deploying distributed resources. What insights do you have about DERs now that you've been in this field for a while that you didn't appreciate before?
The customer engagement piece of it. You know, because I think when I started my career, I was focusing primarily on large utility scale front the meter assets. And, you know, building that out, the National Solar Mission was announced back in 2009. And the very first plants that got built under Tata Power, which is where I was working, that all of that was happening at the time, right? But now when you're looking at a lot of the innovation, the growth, the activity, the dynamism in the industry, it's all behind the meter. And anytime you're going behind the meter, as Apoorv said, you are touching something that's personal to a customer, right? But where the machine learning and AI piece comes into it is that we think about this as a network of distributed DERs that need to be orchestrated and managed to deliver flexibility. Now, whether that's an EV, whether that's a smart thermostat, a water heater, a behind-the-meter storage, a microgrid, it's how do you do this consistently? How do you account for behavioral impacts? How do you use all of this data that you're getting back from the assets to be able to predict what you'll get, to be able to deliver it for network management use cases, for the system level use cases on extremely hot days or cold days? And then also as an alternate source of supply, which is where the virtual power plant concept comes into play, right? Why should I dispatch a peaker power plant when I can get the same flexibility from customer-sided assets? But the what's changed fundamentally is how to engage those customers in a way where you're ensuring that their needs and their use of that asset is being secured while you're still delivering value for the grid at large, right? And that involves a combination of customer engagement solutions that may not be AI-driven, but also using all of that data to be able to drive and deliver more nuanced insights, perhaps.
So I brought you all here, and I purposely didn't give you the questions. And I saw maybe slightly worried looks on your faces as we started here. But I'm going to get your insights, but also test your knowledge about some of the underlying issues happening in the power sector that we're all trying to solve and that AI fits into. So first, let's just start broadly with the AI piece. And I'm going to ask each of you this question. According to PwC, what could be the economic impact of AI on the global economy by 2030? What's the dollar figure, do you think? David, you start.
It's enormous. Goldman Sachs had a study a couple of years ago, and the global impact in GDP is trillions, and it's in the low percentages, 1 to 5 potentially, depending on the time frame.
Apoorv, what do you think it is?
The percentage point of GDP?
No, the dollar figure. What do you think the dollar figure is?
I'm a former management consultant, so I don't read a lot of management consulting reports. and I would say it's probably, because we like the T word, probably $2 trillion.
Okay. Sadia?
I mean, somewhere recently I had heard that someone, I can't remember who exactly, I'll look this up later, but someone was raising funds for AIs, and like the amount of funds they were raising were in the trillions. So I think...
Yeah, the Sam Altman looking for $7 trillion exactly. just for chips
alone.
So
I think the economic impact is going to be like 100x that.
Yeah, so PwC says $15.7 trillion to the global economy by 2030. That's more than the current output of China and India combined. And of this, $6.6 trillion will likely come from increased productivity, and $9.1 trillion is likely to come from consumption side effects. So people just selling more stuff. And you know. So where do you all stand
really
on
need.
AI generally? Like, if you look at the surge of interest across society and across a wide range of business sectors, and then in energy specifically, like, where do you think we are in this adoption curve? What do you think, David? Like, where are we right now with AI generally?
It's a great question, and it can be hard to get a temperature check. I think, though, there's two ways to look at how AI is impacting society and the world of business. First, there's the enterprise impacts, which are pretty common across industries, right? So these are impacts to supply chain, procurement, HR, finance, legal. And we're seeing solutions that adopt well in one industry scale pretty well across all industries. And that's in flight. And, you know, using generative AI for enterprise transformation and re-envisaging how a company's managed is well underplay. I think the second piece is to look at the industry-specific transformation that's going on. And there's been a lot of ink spins on this, right? If you look at perhaps... you know, computer science or gaming or entertainment, you could have a completely new products, new services, new ways to market. I think higher in that spectrum in terms of impact are professional services, management consultants, maybe automated, legal services. So you can see, you know, the impact is on regulation heavy, document heavy, analysis type work. Where it gets more interesting, and which is why energy and utilities is interesting, is when you're further down the spectrum, you're looking at life sciences or healthcare or heavily regulated in industries like energy and utilities. The adoption is very much driven by, you know, this nexus of customer satisfaction, policy, technology readiness, protection of critical infrastructure, and decision making is very different and very conservative and risk advising. And I think that impacts how AI has been rolled out across the sector. But it's not even, and each sector is on its own transformational journey, but each sector is being transformed. That's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Sadia, what do you think? Where are we in this like transformational stage?
Yeah. So I think, when you're talking about the incorporation of AI into technologies, like we delivered 10 million forecasts in under 10 minutes a decade ago, right? So I think the idea that somehow AI is being newly incorporated into technologies is false. Many companies have been around and have been actively incorporating these new technologies. I think what's changed now is much more of the focus on generative AI and how do you think about that in the context of productivity gains, right? Like how do you make the work and tasks easier for people who are, you know, involved in very rote, routine kinds of things, right? And especially in the utility context or in the power sector context, there are certain processes that take a really long time. like interconnections when you're talking about in the context of DERs, right? How do we accelerate those processes through the use of these technologies? I think given how conservative, I think, or the power sector generally is, I don't see an immediate adoption of these kinds of technologies for productivity gains, because the things like, you know, financial statements getting released and those kinds of pieces of news, that's a big issue, right? Like anything IP related or proprietary information, you're not comfortable just having that be available. So I think it's going to take some time, or the technology has to evolve where that level of privacy and security is possible. Then I think this will start to become much more commonplace. As of now, it's a tool that we all like using and seeing, okay, let me see what, you know, this ChatGPT thing does and spits out. I think it'll take some time before we really see an incorporation of that into the power sector workforce.
Apoorv, are you going to live forever?
Because of AI?
Yeah.
I think I wouldn't want to impose that on the world. I mean, the biggest thing that AI has done for me recently is it's made our part of the mission in San Francisco super cool, because literally OpenAI's offices are next door to ours. Next door. And so that means when we go for lunch, we're like, oh, that's a bunch of OpenAI engineers.
So your responses on ChatGPT are like milliseconds faster?
Oh, definitely. Like, I think we share the same internet connection. So, I mean, aside from being in the arena, which is what that area of San Francisco is now called, look, I completely agree, which is like foundationally, AI has actually existed in a lot of energy services and products for a while.
Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons I use the word machine learning is because I actually think that AI has become too hypey and too associated with generative AI.
Yeah.
And I think generative AI is like when the consumer figured out that AI is available to them. But I'm not quite sure what the generative AI impact today is on utilities, except for one very specific thing. Data centers are going to get real hairy. It is going to be a lot of load coming on very, very, very quickly. And the power sector has not dealt with that much load that quickly when you've got a gigawatt and a half, you know, data center coming online. And that's the kind of thing that's changing. But just very quickly, yeah, machine learning is a thing we've been incorporating as part of our tooling in our products and services from day one. And I really think of it as data was what you needed. Then you needed forecasting, where machine learning came in. And I think forms of AI have been used for a while. Mm. What outcomes they deliver, that I think is often driven by data siloing. And the more you can break those data silos within any enterprise organization, the more value that machine learning gives you. And I think part of the reason that AI has not been as exciting to a lot of power sector clients is the silos have existed for far too long, right? You got 18 different systems, each of which don't talk to one another. You talk about, hey, can you give me an API? And people scratch their head. And so that kind of handshake and the inability to get data going across different silos means that your machine learning is now just stuck on your data silo.
Yeah, I agree with most of that. I think that the power of generative AI in the utility sector is like customer interactions, document management, using language to sort through all sorts of complicated documents and regulatory filings. Like, that could certainly be
helpful. I love the application for regulatory filings. I think that's going to be one place where I'm like, yes, give me all that reg filing in a single place.
Suddenly, it feels like everyone is focused on the energy demands of AI. On May 8th, I'll be talking with three experts about the AI energy boom. Brian Janis is co-founder of Cloverleaf Infrastructure. He's the former VP of Energy at Microsoft, who saw how the rise of ChatGPT complicated clean energy procurement. Michelle Solomon is a senior policy analyst at Energy Innovation. She co-authored a new report on the many ways utilities can meet rising demand without building new gas plants. And John Belizaire is the CEO of Soluna. He's focused on building data centers for batch processing that utilize excess renewables. We're going to be talking about forecasts for AI power demand, acute impacts for the grid, the rush to gas, alternative solutions like storage and grid-enhancing technologies, data center design, and also the positive benefits of AI for managing demand on the grid. And you can sign up for free for this remote event by clicking the link in the show notes or heading on over to latitudemedia.com/events. We will see you at Transition AI on May 8th.
Okay, so let's go into some of the bigger changes happening along the power grid and where automation fits in. This is a question for all of you. According to the Department of Energy, we're going to need new resources to meet this amount of peak demand by 2030 because of new load like data centers, electric vehicles, broader electrification, manufacturing facilities, and then also retiring coal plants. So what is that capacity amount that we will see in new peak demand by 2030? What do you guess?
70 gigawatts.
70 gigawatts, you said? Sadia?
100.
David?
38.
The answer is 200.
Okay.
It's big. So David, there's this big question about like the energy impact of AI, but also the net benefit to the energy system of using AI to enable more clean energy and a more, you know, dynamic grid. Where's AI going to be most useful in addressing this challenge, this new peak load challenge across VPPs and asset management?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you're right. Google estimates that 15% of their load growth is going to be AI or is AI right now, right? So that's one data point we have. We don't know how much AI will contribute overall, but it's going to contribute significantly. And that's an interesting challenge in that, obviously, utilities are dealing with load growth issues more broadly, but can they use AI to solve this problem? It's a very interesting kind of, you know, nexus of issues. I think what we saw, we spoke with utilities, innovation departments, IT executives, and really got a sense of where they're deploying AI right now. What we saw was any solutions focused on reducing O&M found a home. So, you know, O&M in the utility sector generally going up 40% per year per utility. So anything that can reduce asset management costs, inspection costs, yeah, automate processes, use new multimodal data, image data, do better substation asset management, that's finding a home and actually scaling quite quickly. And utilities have a level of maturity there now that they really did build in the last 10 or 15 years. You know, digital twins and moving to from anomaly detection to real scenario analysis is a real thing. And we're seeing huge value being leveraged from that. And that's been solved by some of the, you know, the knowledge retention issues that utilities have too. Any automation in that space is actually welcome. So we're seeing a lot of applications on T&D, grid infrastructure management. I think what we mentioned earlier that, I mean, AI has been used on the grid for quite a while. I mean, machine learning has been used in load forecasting since the 70s, right? Statistical analysis. So that's not new. I think what's new is these new forms of external data that the utilities can leverage in their processes, whether it be satellite imagery or weather data or in the customer end, socioeconomic data. And I think bringing all that data in is giving utilities, you know, just better decision-making tools and processes. But I think the key thing to note is that it's a regulated industry. So O&M reductions are going to go first. And then NERC-SIP assets and those types of processes are going to take a long time.
Yeah.
And I think where Uplight and WeaveGrid are focused is really exciting because of the, you know, customer propensity model and the changing relationship with utilities and the available. We're at 75% AMI deployment now in the U.S., those types of solutions where utilities want to own the customer relationship a little bit more and where you can monetize some of that data and some of those relationships is really a growth sector. So just to break it down, Stephen, I mean, it's operations first and foremost where we're seeing most of the deployments, load forecast still and traditionally, and we're seeing a whole bunch at the edge of the grid. And that's not, that we didn't even mention power flow solutions, things like, you know, moving from static to dynamic line rating and solving congestion problems. So it is this kind of incremental journey, but it is really exciting. And, you know, utilities are using natural language processing, computer vision. They are using machine learning. They are using generative AI for some data gaps they have too. So there's a whole host of capabilities that are being rolled out right now. And yeah, different utilities are at different stages, but that's the kind of general journey.
This one is in your wheelhouse, Apoorv. So according to the Brattle Group, what would the annual demand of peak load of adding 20 million EVs onto the grid be by 2030? Let's talk energy demand and capacity.
Let's see. 20 million EVs, you're saying?
Yeah, 20 million EVs by 2030.
Trying to do the math here. Yeah. I would guess it's somewhere on the order of 50 to 60 gigawatts.
What do you think, Sadia?
I mean, what, 4 kilowatts an EV times 20 million? yeah, 80, 100, probably.
50?
10 to 20 gigawatts of peak load to the system.
Oh, wow.
Requiring 12 to 18 gigawatts of renewable capacity.
I don't
capacity.
Need management consulting. what I do my own analysis.
what is the number, though? So load forecast, a number of years ago, it was projected to grow at around 2.5%, right? And I think the revision, right, and some of the industry accepted numbers are closer to 5% now in general. Is that right?
Yes. The other aspect of it is also that when do these loads come on, right? It's not necessarily coming on at the same time that the system is peaking, which means that the system actually has some capacity to be able to absorb some of this load, but then it also adds a little lot more.
Yeah, I think one of the things I'll maybe just caution is, like, again, not poking fun of anything, but, like, I think the reality is, like, when you're doing a top-down model, X million multiplied by X kilowatts, what it fails to recognize, and this is where AI is important, is what is the vehicle? Is it a bus?
Yeah.
Is it an F-150? Is it a plug-in Prius? What power is it charging at? Where is it charging? And for how long is it charging? Those questions are super critical because, 20 million into 7 kilowatts is a really easy math problem, but it's not actually solving the real issue of how am I going to ingest all of those vehicles onto the grid? How am I going to optimize them? And how am I going to plan for them? Right? I heard this amazing framework from one of our clients, which was we have to plan, we have to serve, and we have to manage. And I would argue that serving and managing are actually two sides of the same coin when you're thinking about customer-side resources. Yes, you have to plan for 10 extra gigawatts coming online, but you cannot think about serving and managing as two separate things. And that's what they have been historically. Management of your thermostats existed in one side of the house. Serving the thermostats by having somebody build out the cul-de-sac lived in a different part of the house. Guess what? Today, they have to live in the same side. And I think, you know, it's highly irregular and sad that Nehruk is happening at the same moment as DistribuTech here. But regulators need to be getting ahead as well and saying, how do we ensure that we are giving utilities the flexibility to go plan and build out these things with management schema in mind, with these programs in mind, so that we can accommodate 20 million vehicles and make that all possible? Because, five trucks at a depot is more painful to some of our clients than 5,000 vehicles in a neighborhood. But sometimes 5,000 neighborhoods is actually 10x the cost of 5 extra vehicles, trucks at a truck stop.
Okay, this next one is in your wheelhouse, sure. Sadia. According to the Department of Energy, we have this much virtual power plant capacity in the U.S. currently. How many gigawatts?
We ourselves are like 8 gigawatts. So I would say under 50, I think.
You're in the spot. Yeah. Anybody want
to? I think I listened to your podcast recently where we were featured. So let's see. I think it was like 50 to 70 is what I remember.
You're close. You're in the zone.
I'm going to go with 38 again.
You're all in the zone. I mean, it was 30 to 60 gigawatts, and it really depends on how you classify a virtual
It's a sandwich, right?
It's a sandwich, exactly. giant hoagie. How do you define virtual power plants? Like, there are so many different definitions. How do you classify the space?
So a virtual power plant is an aggregation of DERs that cut across customer and asset classes, right? Because from a utility perspective, what they're trying to do is that there are all of these DERs that are coming up in different parts of the network, right? How do we aggregate, orchestrate, optimize, forecast, optimize, and dispatch these assets as if they're a collective unit? And the most relevant comparable in a virtual power plant context would be a peaker plant that runs maybe 5% of the hours in a year and serves during those critical periods for the grid, right? So that's the way I would define a virtual power plant. And I think a key aspect to it is to recognize that it's, you know, it doesn't have to be a single asset class. Like, that's not the way I would define a virtual power plant. It is multi-asset, multi-customer, and it is an aggregation of these assets together, because that way you are able to engage the largest group of customers on the utility side, incentivize them, and also engage them in this programmatic manner, right? Earlier we had talked about the customer behavior and the customer impacts and how do you account for that while also serving the grid. And doing these two things in a way where both interests are accounted for, what we refer to as like co-optimizing or, you know, value stacking in some ways is, I think, the key aspect of it.
Yeah, I guess maybe where I'll jump in a little bit is, like, I like different kinds of sandwiches too, like you said on your previous podcast. And maybe my view is that that's not where the industry is today. Like, internally, when we talk to a lot of utilities, they say we want the best-in-class applications for solving the problem that the application is going to provide the most value for. And where I get tripped up by the word virtual power plant, and where my mind just eventually goes back to thinking of it as sparkling demand response, essentially, is ultimately, like, we have to define the value stack. And if we're going to call it a power plant, then power plants provide XYZ value. I think the problem or the opportunity with a lot of different asset types is that they can provide a lot more value than a traditional power plant, and they can also provide a lot less value than a traditional power plant. And I think one of the areas where we actually see EVs being very distinct, and why I like my cheese sandwich specifically, is I do think that EVs play a very different role in the customer journey and the customer experience more than other flavors of DERs do. And so, you know, from my perspective, you know, these are mobile, flexible energy resources. And so their mobility comes first and foremost. It is a device not built for energy purposes. Please deal with the automakers. They will tell you how much they do not care about the energy parts. First and foremost, they want to make sure the trim and the color and leather and everything else feels good. It drives the way you want it to drive. And then they want to think about the energy, like, you know, sprinkles on top. Because that's where we're at. And that's what a car is good for, first and foremost. Oh my God, it also has immense flexibility, right? Immense flexibility for the power sector. And so that's where I do really think that there is a unique and differentiated view on how those VPPs are going to show up. And I definitely think that, like, we're going to see bundling of those different assets at a utility level. And I think that's where AutoGrid, Uplight, et cetera, are doing great work of creating the structure and the framework. But you're going to have best-in-class applications provide the best-in-class value. And I don't think that I'm going to go build a better thermostat than Nest. I just don't think I am. So why should I pretend that I'm going to do all of those things? In the same way, I don't think Nest is going to go do things in EVs because they're not as good at it.
Okay, final question here. You are all selling to, working with, working inside utilities, helping them consult an energy transition, getting them to integrate your products, working with them on dispatching. So, like, you all know utilities very well, the different archetypes of utility adopters. According to David's analysis, 90% of utility decision makers say that AI can positively impact the sector. Is that right, David?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and so you have a wide variety of archetypes you've mapped out, the cautious observer, the experimenters, the enthusiasts, the innovators, and there's a wide spectrum of adoption here. Well, what we see in actual capital expenditures is a little bit different. There was a survey from ABB recently that said 91% say they see of utilities say that they see data science as critical to their success, but the percentage that were actually making capital expenditure decisions for things like predictive analytics was like a quarter of those respondents. So, like, the actual money going into this stuff is very different from what they're saying that they want to do in theory. Do you see a mismatch? Like, I want to hear all your perspectives to round this out. A mismatch between what utilities say they need to do and want to do and what they're actually doing.
Right. I think that's a really, really great question. And it moves beyond the press release management component that's in the industry a little bit. I think it's worth standing back, right, and seeing what the industry has evolved into. In the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, utilities invested in R&D, right? They had large R&D functions. Since restructuring in the mid-90s, R&D expenditure fell by about 75%. And what you saw in the 90s and 2000s was a large capital market, venture capital, at the edge of the grid emerge. And effectively, what utilities are doing because of restructuring is they outsourced innovation to companies like EPRI and to companies at the edge of the grid. And that venture market's booming. So you have this, you know, this macro trend of innovation that's happening outside of the sector, and utilities very much just focused on ROE, their core metrics, you know, delivering the regulated service. And that does impact where they spend money, right? You know, you need to capitalize these investments. And, you know, things like drones might be interesting because it's transforming a process and you can, you know, get 10-year returns on that and it'd be capitalized. And that's why those solutions that reduce O&M see a good home and they capitalize on utility. But are utilities actually investing the dollars that they're talking about, right? I mean, some utilities, one utility we know had a data science team of two people. Actually, that team has grown to 100 now. I mean, that's a material investment. And they're hiring ML engineers. They're building platforms with compute power. But ultimately, regulation needs to occur within the sector changes in order for adoption speeds to ramp up. And I think firms like Uplight and WeaveGrid are the innovation that's at the edge of the grid. And they are forcing the sector to change. They're highlighting the inefficiencies. And in many ways, utilities should be doing this themselves, but they're not incentivized. And I think the capital dollars that are flowing at the edge of the grid now will force utilities over the long term to really reinvent their processes. And I think that the other final piece to that is that, you know, this isn't the first round of investment that we've seen in this sector. I mean, 2009, the American Recovery and Investment Act, we saw billions of dollars flow into smart meters, smart grid plans, digital infrastructure. And utilities have been rolling out sensors and comms networks and data platforms and upgrading their GISs and integrating OMS and DMS systems and so on for many years. Now, there's a foundational capability there now that utilities didn't have when we had this conversation a long time ago. But the typical themes are going to be there. You know, impatient capital, slow utility. You know, there's all this transformative ability there. And I think Abhrav said it. It's about that nexus of regulation, technology readiness, scalability, customer satisfaction, and utility incentive. And that puzzle to square is actually really complicated. But when we square it, it can move pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I just building off of that, I think the very specific kind of things is, let's start rate-basing software. We've been talking about this for 15 years. I worked on it when I was at Opower. We're still talking about it. We're going to keep talking about it. So what's going to end up happening is you're going to have a bunch of companies say, here's my one piece of hardware. Here's 100 million pieces of software. Attach to that piece of hardware, buy my hardware, and get $100 million of software that you get to rate-base. Well, that's silly. That doesn't allow you to do proper like releases. It doesn't allow you to actually have SaaS. It doesn't allow you to implement the best-in-class software tools out there that are critical to actually enabling this future. We've literally died in working groups on whether or not, like, you know, we should be rate-basing software. I don't understand why we're still not doing it, you know? And I think that's the kind of thing that's a very subtle change, right? That we can start to implement at, you know, places like NARUC. We can start to have that conversation and accelerate it. Because the imperative is not just impatient capital, right? I'm an impatient human being. There is impatient capital behind me. The more important imperative in my mind is, like, if we believe we need to deliver a decarbonized, affordable, resilient future in this country, we need to move fast. And we are not going to move fast by hoping that we can just deploy hardware solutions day in, day out that, yes, we'll use AI as well. But by the way, there's a whole bunch of software tools that can help there. And I think that's the problem, is like, this is happening and we need to get ahead of it. And there are simple tools like that. Then, you know, if you want to get in the real guts of regulatory processes, avoided cost frameworks need to change. There is a lot of stuff around VPPs that make zero sense if avoided cost frameworks stay basically compensating us for avoided costs of yesteryear versus avoided costs of future year, which makes no sense again. So there's things like that that, like, the nexus of technology and policy is so critical in this moment. And those two sectors, even within utilities, but definitely within regulators, like, they need to be having a more robust conversation. And unfortunately, there are very few bridges who can speak to both of those very gnarly outcomes in policy land, but also the beautiful future we can have on the consumer and the grid delivery side, right? I mean, that's what we need to be doing.
Sadia, round us out.
I mean, that's pretty much the challenge with anything technology and policy related, right? Like, technology is far outpacing the policy side of things. I mean, I'd like to build off of what David, you've said, and Apoorv. I'll focus on the people and process part of it, right? With utilities that are sort of further down the grid modernization journey, what I've seen is that there's an intentionality behind how they're organizing their leadership and where does the grid team and the customer-sided team sort of report into. If it reports into the same leader at the executive level, then you start to see a lot of these silos breaking down because there's conversations that are happening at that level that start to trickle down, right? If you are going to continue to operate in the sort of traditional paradigm of the grid side looks at the grid and the customer side looks at customers, we're never going to make the kind of progress and scale the way that we want to.
Sadia Ravindran of Uplight, thank you.
Thank you.
Apoor Bhargava of WeaveGrid, thank you.
Thank you.
And David Gruark of Indigo Advisor Group, thanks.
Thank you.
This was fun.
Great fun.
And that's going to do it for the show. If you want to learn more about the utility AI insights research that we put together, go to latitudemedia.com/research. And while you're over at Latitude Media, make sure to subscribe to our newsletter. You'll get all our editorial coverage in your inbox in the middle of the week, and at the end of the week, a roundup of our podcasts. And over on the website, you can find transcripts of these episodes as well. Do us a favor, give us a review and a rating on Apple or Spotify. It's hugely helpful. And the show is produced by me. Sean Marquand is our technical director. He composed our theme song. And Latitude Media is supported by Prelude Ventures. If you want to learn more about their investment strategy in climate tech and their portfolio, go to preludeventures.com. Thanks so much for being here. I am Stephen Lacey. This is The Carbon Copy. We'll catch you next time.